Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thanksgiving Monday, November 24th. We pause to survey the media landscape, fewer newsrooms and shrinking staff. We look at what's ahead and how technology challenges redefine how and what we consume as news. Plus, we often hear about a bad hair day. Today, we look at a flap over hair straightening in the new Moana movie. And rev up those engines, we talk to go-kart enthusiasts on Maui about the sport. Got turkey yet? We meet a couple of young Thanksgiving shoppers on Kauai who tell us about their approach to reinventing the holiday. And a new eatery in Chinatown is turning heads. Giovedi is its name. It means Thursday in Italian. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. By chance this past weekend, I happened to stop into the Friends of the Library bookstore and came across Press Time in Paradise by George Chaplin. The book details the life and times of the Honolulu Advertiser from 1856 to 1995. The Advertiser was one of Honolulu's first non-government newspapers in the Hawaiian Kingdom times, but it no longer exists. We do have the Star Advertiser, which emerged after the Honolulu Star Bulletin went away. My encounter with the book was a chance glance at media history, but it took on new meaning after I had the chance to sit down in our studio last Friday with journalist Sophie Koch, along with UH journalism instructor and former KITV news director Janice Jin. We talked about the changing media landscape. There is a new report out from the Hawaii Institute for Public Affairs, Hawaii's News Desert, Overcoming a Threat to Democracy and Civil Engagement. It was released this month. Sophie Koch compiled a report and starts us off.
Local newspapers really peaked in the late 1970s and early 1980s. It was a period of time in Hawaii where we had a really robust ecosystem for local news. It was really incredible in terms of the diversity of local publications. There were outlets that were dedicated to investigative and enterprise reporting, underground newspapers, single issue newspapers that focused on like environmental issues or the Hawaiian sovereignty movement. And then over the decades and years, we saw this, especially in the past 20 years, this rather precipitous decline, whereas particularly between the years 2000 and present, where today we only have a little over a dozen newspapers still in existence. And that's a decline of, at the height, it was about 52. And so the story about what happened to newspapers has been well told over the years. Essentially, the business model was broken by the internet, and we're still grappling to figure out how to make the business model work. And so we were looking at the erosion and the loss of local publications, but another facet of the research was looking at the decline of reporting power, the loss of reporters. So as the business model was being disrupted and we had major losses of advertising revenue, newsrooms were being depleted. And in Hawaii, over the past 10 years, we've lost about 41% of our newspaper reporters. And the effect of that, I think we all have seen in our daily lives, where the newspapers are becoming increasingly thin. And newsrooms, as they've hemorrhaged reporters and editors, they become less able to adequately cover the important issues facing their communities.
We used to have papers that were papers of record, important news events of the day, and they would document all this for our community. And sadly, we're very thin in that area right now. And Janice, you come from the broadcast side. You were working in San Francisco, and we've seen that market in San Francisco contract. But when you came here to Hawaii, what was your sense as to what was happening on the broadcast side of the picture?
On the broadcast side of the world, I guess the way I position this is that while we see this big decline of news and journalism in general, broadcasting itself, particularly in this market, or not only in this market, is not as dim, as I say. It's like apples and oranges. But the broadcast industry in Hawaii is thriving, and we are seeing more hours of local television. And in fact, one of the stations contacted us after the report to say, hey, we're even adding more streaming, more hours of streaming. So what does that mean? It means that the local stations have more opportunity to tell the news. The question is, how much new news is there? So my argument has always been that it's great to have 10 hours of broadcast time. But if you're running the same story from 1 hour to the next hour to the next hour, then how much news is the public getting? They're just getting the same diet. It's the same cereal. It's the same pancake you're getting every day. You're not changing it up. Is it extended? Could be extended conversations. Could be a lot of things. They're not necessarily happening. And I would say that the impetus for that has everything to do with money and consolidation of what's going on in broadcasting. I don't believe, even though some people believe, that broadcast news is going away or that broadcasting and television is going away because of the internet, because of digital. I think we're here to stay. I think we serve a really big role in our community to share information, particularly in times of emergency, because we are free over the air to get the information. The consolidation is we have major companies that are buying television stations across the country. One of the biggest companies owns one of the stations here in town. The fourth largest company owns one of the stations in town. The fourth largest company and number two company are talking about in the trades, they're going to merge. So now they're going to be this mega, mega company. And then I read yesterday, it's not going to be that company that owns the station locally. It's going to be a totally different company, and they'll still be another mega station. So the two biggest broadcasters in America is Nexstar, which owns KHON, and Sinclair, which owns no properties here. But Sinclair says they think in the end, there's going to be two major conglomerates that will own all of the media. The consolidation allows for the stations to pull together the resources. They can own three stations in the market, but they only need one newsroom. They only need to take the same material, air it on one station, and then air it again or air it simultaneously on the other station. Is that improving our public conversation? I think not. I think that's the scary part about the threat of a news desert. We are going to be able to get our information out, but how much of it? Can we have a longer discussion about it? Can we debate, if you will, some of the issues, even though it may not be huge issues? They could be small issues to a community that they want to know more about. We know, I think, that Hawaii is news interested. As a market, people here want to know things. They want to know what's going on. They're not walking around with blinders on. They want to know things. And our obligation is to try to give it to them. But the idea of consolidation prevents us from doing it. And it's masked by the fact that we have consolidation in stations. We have companies that own three different stations. When I worked at where I used to work at KITV, KITV owns two stations. We used to simulcast some of our newscasts on the other station. Same newscast. Turn onto this channel or turn onto the other channel. Same station. So are you getting anything more? You're not getting anything new. You're not getting it interpreted differently. It's not an analysis. What I learned from COVID, this I thought was very interesting. So when we talk, we don't have enough bodies to cover news. When COVID happened and every day the governor would have a news conference, the health department, somebody had a news conference. I put all those news conferences I could live on TV. Even if we didn't have a reporter, we always had a reporter there, but it wasn't about the reporter. It was about letting the governor speak, letting people speak. And what my feedback was from the audience was they really liked that because they heard from the voices of the real people,
directly,
of the leaders.
Yeah.
And I was even told in some of the newsrooms that they would watch our station because I let all the time be spent doing continuous coverage of a news conference and playing it as long as you could until, I always like to say, until management walks in and says, are you going to give back the airwaves? Mm-hmm. Can we go back to programming? You go, okay, wait, one more question, and just play it. Because the people wanted to know. And I thought that was such a valuable lesson that I hope that other broadcasters would understand.
Yeah. And full disclosure, because I was working in television news as well, and I saw some of that change where fewer reporters, fewer photographers, and then they became multimedia journalists, you know, so team of two now became one. And then you just couldn't cover everything, where we had a very deep newsroom, that became very thin and you had to choose. I've got two reporters today. What are we going to cover? And so the internet and technology has changed things. You know, I remember being out there at Makapu and covering, I think it was a drowning, and I was the first reporter to do live streaming on an iPhone, where our big satellite trucks, you know, they cost, what, $250,000? They could not, because of the location, get out live from that spot. So it's really changed access where we can go. Sophie, you were at Sybil Beat, and they were just all online. They weren't producing newspaper. So yeah, we've had those challenges.
Yeah. Yeah. And the issue isn't whether it's actual print paper or it's online. Everyone's online these days, but it's the disruption of the business model and the loss of reporting power that's really the problem. This report wasn't in any way advocating that we go back to old days of print paper. It's more about trying to define the problem and how that's affecting civic engagement and democracy and trying to figure out what the way forward is.
We've been talking with Sophie Koch and Janice Jin about the state of Hawaii's media. Stay with us. We'll have more from this conversation after a break.
Increase in diagnoses and the really increased awareness, all of this ends up leading to a lot of unintended consequences for the autism community itself. It raised these tensions over which of those needs get prioritized in a world where there's a really limited pile of resources to help.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Let's get back to our conversation with journalist Sophie Koch and former KITV News Director Janice Jin. They were discussing a new report from the Hawaii Institute for Public Affairs, Hawaii's News Desert, Overcoming a Threat to Democracy and Civil Engagement. HIPAA hopes to follow this with a part two.
There is a phase two of the report to really look at communities who have addressed news deserts and how do they do it and have a good business model for doing it. Can I go back a little bit, though, too, about this reporting thing? My discovery, whatever research I could find out, is the number of reporters at television stations really has not gone down as dramatically as they have in newspapers. What they did do was they took the numbers of people in a newsroom and consolidated them. As you said, no more photographers. Well, there are photographers, but the reporter is acting like the photographer and the video editor and the reporter and the writer and the whole thing. They do the whole thing as one element. So that is part of consolidation and cost. When you consolidate, they just want you to be more efficient. So I recall somebody was saying in the early days, there was only six teams of reporters at KHON. When I go back and look at the count of how many reporters that station has, it's about six reporters. So stations have about six reporters. They don't have specialty reporters, and that's not to say that the anchors don't report. But anybody whose job it is to be the reporter out on the street, they're really not a lot, and they probably never were. So I'm saying we're like it's staying at the same level. It's just our jobs have changed, and the demand for those workers are higher than ever.
But there's fewer resources to pull someone out and have them do a deep dive just because you've got a news hole to fill. It's a beast to feed.
Yeah. Got to feed the beast. We just say that all the time.
Anything else that you think would be important, Sophie, just to underscore about what people need to know and why it's important for a strong democracy?
When you have communities that can no longer get basic information about what's going on at the local school board, what's going on at their city council or county council meetings, what's going on at the legislature, it makes it really difficult for them to participate in democracy. Even trying to get information about local elections becomes difficult, the candidates. And so that erosion plays such a huge role, not just in eroding civic engagement and democracy, but also creating a society and communities that are much more polarized, that are operating under a lot of misinformation, a lot of disinformation. Like, on the one hand, we have this loss of local news. On the other hand, people are completely bombarded by this information on the internet that they're increasingly less capable of discerning what is truth versus fact and what has been reported and what's spin and what's disinformation. So it just creates communities that in some ways are really in peril.
You want an informed citizenry. You want informed voters. So when they go in that ballot box, that they're going to know which box to check.
Yeah, and one of the correlations I found through the research in terms of looking at the loss of newspapers and reporters is also a real decline in voter participation over the decades. And that is emblematic in a lot of ways of just that erosion of civic engagement and an informed public.
One thing that pops in my mind is I know the use of VNRs, video news releases, and I have seen how newsrooms have become thin. And while in the past there had been a decision, we're not using those, we're going to shoot our own video and we're going to send our own reporters and not just have something canned sent to us, there is more of that in use. And sometimes the viewer does not know that.
I think that's true. I can tell you like what I did when I was a news director, but I'm passe. But I think you have to have policies and standards that follow in your newsroom. So my policy was, I'll take your B-roll, I won't take your interview. Because if a PR person is giving you the interview, it's going to be positive. So if you only want to write a positive story, if you're going to do that as a journalist, take the positive and go find the other side. Because we always know there's two sides of the story. Now that takes a lot more work. If you don't have enough people in your newsroom to do that work, then you're better off just running the VO. You just take the video. There's some realities of what we do or how we put our works together that I call it the realities of the business. But you have to protect yourself or say, this is what they gave us. This is what the hospital wants you to know.
Right. Have a policy in place, whether it's for AI or whatever else. Anything else you want to underscore?
I think I just want to underscore that there are communities that have faced serious news desert situations. And there have been people in those communities who found a way to use other resources. I'm not talking money. I'm talking about people to go and get information, use the technology, which is digital, to disseminate that information. But you have to create this idea that who's collecting the information is trustworthy, credible, and honest, so that the information I'm telling you about the school board meeting is true. I mean, I've always wanted to read what happened in the school board meeting. Not that I really wanted to attend. I just want to know, what did they decide? Who said what? Which leader that I elected into the board said what? Who did they vote? All those pieces of information. So what we have are some communities out there in the mainland that are using students or student projects, university student projects, to be the reporters. And then using the platform, whatever platform that might be, to disseminate that information. How well it's being received, I can't tell you. I just can tell you that those kinds of efforts are being done, sometimes maybe in conjunction with maybe an NPR station or something like that. But it's really important that we teach the next generation the importance of getting information and sharing the information. And that's what we want. That's what we're afraid of having a desert and we can't do anything about it. And we're going to all thirst.
Being thirsty in a news desert. That was Janice Jin and Sophie Cock talking about a new report out, Hawaii's News Desert, Overcoming a Threat to Democracy and Civil Engagement. We'll have links on our website later today. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukauai, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaii.
If Hawaii's avian populations were a high school, you might say the Hawaiian goose or the nene are the popular kids. It's the state bird, gaining that distinction in 1957. It's mentioned in the Kumulipu, the Hawaiian creation chant, as a symbolic joining force between the mountains and the coast. And its endangered species status grants them special protection. Historically, they were found on all main Hawaiian islands, but today colonies are only found on the islands of Hawaii, Maui, Kauai, and Molokai. And believe it or not, in one international location. Decades ago, when the nene was in danger of going completely extinct, a conservationist named Peter Scott brought breeding pairs to his reserve thousands of miles away from our islands. Some of their descendants were later released into the wild in Hawaii, while several hundred still live at the reserve. For today's backyard quiz, where is that reserve located? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, NereidHawaii.com.
Soulful Hawaii musician Isaac will be performing music from his latest album, Kowa, in our Atherton studio. Enjoy his emotionally resonant lyrics and melodies that draw inspiration from a wide range of artists. It's the final concert in our Live from the Atherton Celebrate 808 series. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
The phrase Bad Hair Day takes on new meaning with the remake of the film Moana. Here to talk about it is HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what? Is there a trailer out and people are reacting to this?
Yeah, so last week on Monday, Disney released their live-action remake trailer, Moana, and this comes almost actually a decade after the live-action Moana came out. But there was one thing that stood out to a lot of fans of the animated film, which is this actress's hair. And so when it was revealed towards the very end of the trailer that the actress who plays Moana actually has straight hair, that kind of struck a chord with some Pacific Islander communities, and a lot of them took to social media to express frustration over this actress's hair. And the actress who plays Moana in the live-action film is named Catherine Lunga'aia. She is Australia. Her dad is also a well-known actor named Jay Lunga'aia as well. But in her IMDb profile, which is her actor profile, she actually has very curly, coarse hair, even curlier than mine, very spiral. But a lot of fans took offense to that. And it hit here locally in Hawaii, too. Representative Janae Campella, who has naturally curly hair, she said she was disappointed in watching the trailer with her daughter, who also has curly hair.
There are lots of different emotions around Moana, just the animated version of it. But as like a young brown woman, as Native Hawaiian who grew up here in Hawaii, luckily like surrounded by other brown people, it was so nice and so refreshing to be able to see something put out by Disney that represented me and represented little girls like me. And when they came out to do the live action, I was also so excited. But when you actually watch the trailer, the thing that is the most striking is her hair. And I just have to say that as someone who has curly hair and knows how hard it is to be vulnerable and wear your hair natural when there is so much straight hair bias in this world, we all knew what Moana's hair should have looked like, and Disney's version of it does not look. It's not Pacific Islander hair. And I think for me, that was devastating. And I think it was even more devastating to sit there with my daughter, who has curly hair as well, and to know that Disney didn't feel like it was good enough for their screen. That's the kind of message that Disney is sending right now to young women with curly hair.
And what fans of the film really wants is accurate representation of Pacific Islander hair. And Pacific Islanders, there's various textures of hair. You have the straight hair, the wavy hair, curly hair, and even like coarse, coily, kinky hair. There's a diverse group of textures in the Pacific. But they want that representation on film, and seeing that straight hair actually garnered, I think, nearly 50,000 likes on social media from this one post, and then more than 7,000 shares. And some commenters on that social media post commenting the live action Moana trailer accused Disney of so-called whitewashing this character. And some of the commenters said that even though they know that Moana is a fictional character, she still has this representation of Pacific Islander traits such as hair. And I also spoke with Moses Goods. He's a local actor who is mixed with Native Hawaiian and Black, so his hair is very curly and coarse. But he actually expressed kind of disappointment about the trailer.
When the trailer came out and it was pointed out, I also felt, you know, sort of just can't help but feel hurt in situations like that, when it's an opportunity to highlight the full beauty of who we are as people, including our hair. Because I believe the Maui character, Dwayne Johnson's character, has hair that is, you know, much fuller, but he's also sort of the comic relief in the show. And so what is that saying? You know, that the lead has to have what is considered beautiful by some, which is straight hair, and then the comic relief has the other type of hair, which makes that the silly type of hair, the hair that is not desirable. And a lot of people think that we're overthinking this, but I think we should talk about this and we should analyze these things and think about what they mean.
And the reason why he said that is that you look at films like The Legend of Johnny Lingo, the 1969 film, where the main character, Mahana, was considered ugly and she has very curly, coarse hair. But as she married to a wealthy man, as she grew older, her hair also seemed to be blow-dried, straight, and curled as well. It's very similar to like The Princess Diaries, if you saw the main character's hair. But Ralph Milani actually defended the film and their decision of why they had to straighten the young actress's hair.
Meaning the hair has to look exactly the same in wind, in humidity, in rain. It has to be consistently the same through the entire process of making the movie. And that is not always possible with natural hair, because you don't have time to keep going in and restyling the hair. Also with things like CGI, because this is a live action film and there is a lot of action, and the majority of her part is supposed to be on the water, on a boat. So it's easier for CGI and all of that to be done on hair that isn't so voluminous and so textured, because they don't have the technology to match up a lot of these natural textures, so it wouldn't look real. Also, when you're shooting in a studio like Moana was in Atlanta in a giant water tank, you can't always have a hairstylist run in and fix it. So it's easier if the hair is a little smoother, if it's a little easier to control.
Yeah, so it's a technical thing versus a, maybe people are taking it as a slight, but, you know, it's really technical, and that's what's driving this decision.
And it's the continuity, and Ralph Milani is a Native Hawaiian hairstylist here in Hawaii.
Okay, yeah, interesting issues. But yeah, technology is important, because that's all part of it. Maybe they could put more emphasis in the technology and working those kinks out. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Are you passionate about local journalism? skilled at identifying a range of voices and perspectives? HPR is hiring a full-time producer to work on The Conversation, our flagship daily news and talk show. Read the full job description and apply at hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
The Democrats are divided. Should the progressives or the moderates define what it means to be the party of the left-ish? The strategists have theories.
This is why the Democratic Party loses, because they're stuck in a boardroom somewhere yelling at each other.
Whither the Big D Democrats on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
And now it's time for the answer to today's Backyard Quiz. Earlier we asked you, where in the world is there a population of Nene outside of Hawaii? Well, the story starts in 1952, when there were only 30 total Nene left in our state. That's when Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust conservationist Peter Scott took a pair to start a breeding colony at his facility in Slimbridge, England, which is the answer to today's Backyard Quiz. 10 years later, in 1962, 35 birds were born and raised there, and they were brought to Hawaii and released into the wild on the island of Hawaii and Maui. That's our quiz. We had no winners. We stumped you on that one. If you have an idea for a quiz, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. For the first time in 6 years, go-kart racers got a chance to race their hearts out in time trials. HPR's Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel was there on Maui this month at a raceway park to talk about the experience. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so what was that like, go-karters? Huh? I mean, how old do you have to be to get in one of those things?
Well, you can actually be as young as 5. The Maui Go-Karters Association is the only place to drive carts on Maui, and they have members who are ages 5 through 80. And it's located just north of Kihei in the Maui Motorsports Park. They have a raceway there. They have a motocross track. And they have this go-kart track. And you drive through this winding dirt road. Kind of feels like in the middle of nowhere. But they have, a track and a club. And they do it. They're out there every Saturday practicing. And, you know, they hadn't had a race since the pandemic, like you said, for about 6 years. And they just had their first time trial race since then, just recently. So that was an exciting step for the club to get back into it. But, you know, I thought of go-karts as you know, I don't know what I thought. But they drive up to 70 miles an hour in races. And they talked about the physical stresses of the G-forces going around those turns in the track. You know, it's real. Club President Adam Auerbach has been trying to revive the club and bring back racing. Auerbach talks about how the club operates.
A lot of it's just about having fun. I mean, just karting is just so grassroots. It's so raw. It's just a fun sport to be involved in. And then, yes, it can lead to other levels of racing. And for Maui, I mean, anywhere, it all starts at the club level. And then those that have aspiration and talent can move on if they desire to the next level. Usually means you're going to have to get off the island at some point. We have a test arrive and drive test program. It's not something where it's like a rental car program where you can come every week and do that. It's for aspiring karters who want to get a feel for the sport before they have to invest time and money into it. That's mostly what club kart racing is all about, is having your own kart, having your own team, wrenching on your own stuff, having your dad wrench on it, or you wrench on it side by side, or your daughter, mother, whoever. It is a very family-oriented sport.
You know, listening to those carts zip around, I mean, gosh, but they go 70 miles an hour. That's crazy.
It is. And it's you know, it's serious business for some of them. Like he said, you know, a lot of them are in it for fun. But one person I talked to who is very serious about it is a 14-year-old driver from Maui named Judah Dubois. And he has been racing on the mainland. And his goal is to start, you know, he started in the club and he wants to get to Formula One racing in Italy. And he's, you know, he's on his way. He's making his way there. So, you know, for a lot of folks, it's just a fun hobby. And for some others, you know, like Auerbach talked about, you know, that's, it's a starting point and then they can go on to bigger races after that. So Tim Hultquist is a longtime board member of the club. He got his start with mechanics and passion for driving back in high school. And his dad, he and his dad built their own kind of makeshift cart, as he described it. But the club officially got their start in the early 1980s on Maui. And Hultquist recalls how they started racing before that.
The club used to race on the drag strip in the paved pit parking area. And they set up temporary course with the cones to race around. And then at that time became our club president, Enos Kaliehu. He discovered this land we're at now that had all this kind of old abandoned, not runway area, but it was the storage where they used to park the planes during World War II. And then over the years, it's just steady improvement. You know, instead of trying to race on World War II asphalt, you know, we did fundraising and got a pavement area done. And then over the years, we've done the lighting, and then we did the, you know, curbs and the fencing we've done just to make, you know, safety improvements, because that's our number one thing is, you know, it's good to have fun, but you also have to have a safe facility. And from there, it's just been a, you know, a steady, you know, slow and steady kind of thing. When we do race events, we have now, instead of old school paper and pencil scoring, we actually have transponders on the carts. So it's come a long way from what it started as.
Wow, but Maui's so fortunate they have a raceway parked to hang out with, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And Auerbach talked about, you know, how he feels like it's a good outlet for folks who, you know, just want to get out there and have the need for speed. And, you know, this is kind of a safe place to do that. And, you know, these kids are out there. They don't have their driver's license yet, but they can start with driving go-karts. You know, the 14-year-old Judah talked about how he actually learned driving in a video game when he was 6 years old, and that's kind of how he got his passion for it. And then when he was 12, he, you know, moved onto the track with the club. And yeah, you know, it's they have a lot of fun, but you know, they're involved in, you know, the mechanical aspect of it. They all have to do their own maintenance and work on their carts, and they're out there every Saturday. You know, as they talked about, it's a real family friendly atmosphere. When I was there, you know, there were dads and kids working on their carts together, and yeah, it's a cool place to hang out on the weekends. And they're trying to kind of build back up membership. They have about 50 folks who come out and looking to grow back to what it used to be. They used to have crowds come out for the races. So one of these days soon.
All right. Well, it's great. I mean, you mentioned family friendly, and you know, Maui, very fortunate they have a place to go. But thanks so much, Catherine.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All righty. That was HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel with a story about go-karting on Maui. Time now for a special Thanksgiving edition of What's in Your Cart. The Conversation C.W. Gibson went to Kauai on Friday to ask shoppers about their plans for Thursday's holiday. He met Adeline outside the Big Save in Kapa'a. She recently moved to Kauai from the hill country of Texas and was shopping with her friend Erica. They live together in Mo'ala'a. Adeline starts us off.
We've come for eggs, but what I want to get for my Thanksgiving, like, potluck is, like, a cornbread bake, where it's, like, corn pudding, kind of, but with, like, Jiffy mix in there, and you toss it all in there.
Is this your own creation?
No, this is Instagram found. Yeah, this was a reel. There's this lady who does everything but the turkey. Everything but the turkey. And she does all these sides and desserts, and it's absolutely delightful, and she does, like, all these potato dishes. It's lovely.
Food prices, they've been going up this year a lot. Does that figure in at all to sort of how you plan for Thanksgiving for the holiday?
Yes. So you can't afford to make a whole Thanksgiving dinner all by yourself, so you go in with friends and you make sure that everyone brings a side, someone's got the turkey, and it's a real potluck style. Like, everyone's got to come together and make the meal together. I've managed to make like a good group of friends in Kauai already, and I really enjoy the community out here and being able to be like so accepted so soon and being able to bring new friends in with me and like just know that everyone's going to be having a nice meal, especially so far away from home. It's really nice to have home away from home like that.
How long have you been here?
I've been here 2 months. I was working on a dairy farm. Now we're working on a veggie farm. So we're going real farm to table with it.
Nice. Where were you before that?
I was in Texas, right in between San Antonio and Austin. San Marcos.
But see, now you seem to have some mixed feelings about Thanksgiving. What is your take on Thanksgiving?
Well, I've grown up celebrating it. Thanksgiving is like an American holiday, and I'm all about people coming together and sharing food. I think that's a beautiful thing. I just think it's also important that we recognize that for many Native people, this is like what Thanksgiving celebrates, is that first meal has a lot more to the story than meets the surface.
Maybe inherently in what the two of you have said, sometimes you need to reinvent a holiday, right? Give it new purpose.
Reclamation is the word that I've been using for it.
That was HBR's E.W. Gibson talking with Adeline and Erica, two young shoppers. They were outside the Big Save in Kapa'a on Kauai. How are food prices shaping your approach to Thanksgiving? We do want to hear from you. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Bon Appetit magazine recently honored a new eatery in Chinatown as one of the 20 best restaurants in the country for 2025. Giovedi is a little gem located on Fort Street that also just won the Holly Aino Award for Best New Restaurant. It's in good company at that location, sandwiched between fellow award winners Fett and Mamo Pizza. HBR contributor Sarah Bouchard caught up with the owners of Giovedi to talk about their big win and the path that they took to get there. Sarah has history with the owners, Jen Akiyoshi and Chef Baotran, working with them when they ran Mad Bean in Kapolei. And fun fact, she also helps out as a part-time server at Giovedi.
So we actually met in New York City working together at a restaurant. It was the first restaurant where I was the chef at. It was called Santina in the West Village. I think what drew us together was our love of not just food, but hospitality in general. I think we both come from families that really like to express their love and feelings through serving each other as a family. And we wanted to carry that kind of message forward. And I think in New York, we learn a lot of skills, like hard skills, but kind of translating the spirit of service was something we always wanted to do ourselves. We always like to cook for our friends and family. And I think kind of moving to Hawaii, where Jennifer was born and raised, really gave us the opportunity to kind of really take a step back and explore what it means to provide hospitality, not just in a restaurant sense, but more as a community. So we moved to Chinatown about a year after we first moved back to Hawaii, and just definitely fell in love with the neighborhood. Just the old school charm, the great restaurant scene here that existed, and just the sense of community was like greater than anything I have experienced in New York. And it's always been our dream to kind of open a restaurant in the neighborhood that we live in. And after opening Giovedi about a year and a half ago, we've definitely felt that sense of community through all of our neighbors, our guests that live locally here and from other parts of Oahu coming to visit us. It's been a very humbling, but also a very magical experience, seeing our vision come to life and serving the community that we love and that we're proud to be a part of.
Jen, you want to add anything to that?
Sure. Giovedi, the name of the restaurant, means Thursday in Italian. And there's kind of a misconception that people think we wanted to open a restaurant because of these parties that we used to throw for our friends on Thursdays. But in reality, one thing that I think Bao and I found when moving back to Honolulu, we found that restaurants had excellent food, excellent service, but sometimes felt a little uncomfortable. And so the restaurant that we envisioned and the restaurant that we dreamed of, we wanted to have a place where people felt like they were in our home, where they were comfortable being themselves, where they felt like they could relax, kick back, be loud, have a date, celebrate something, maybe have a bad day and come to the restaurant and feel like they were at home. And so for us, seeing that dream come true has been like the most rewarding part of this whole process.
Tell me a little bit about how you got to Chinatown as far as opening Giovedi, what it's been like being on the street that you're on. They're on Hotel in Nu'uanu, which is a very popular street for bars and restaurants. You're next door to Fet, which is a very lively place. You kind of took over for Encore, which was a crowd favorite too. How has that been slipping into that space?
Bao and I decided to go 100% in on this project at the end of 2022. We were working for another restaurant group, and we realized that no matter how much we were told we had creative vision, we knew deep down that we would never have full creative vision where we could see our dream and our vision 100% come to fruition. So we went all in. We quit our jobs with no real plan in place. And we sat down and we decided, okay, we can go to a farmer's market and we can sell 100 $10 things, or we could do some sort of pop-up where we sell 10 $100 things. So we chose the latter. And one of our friends who sells takeout boxes was at the former Vino space and selling something and asked, would you be willing to do this pop-up thing? And he called me, and that's how we found our pop-up space in the former Vino private dining room upstairs. There were 6 tables. We started this pop-up in February of 2023 and used that time to find a permanent brick and mortar space. I looked at probably 20 spaces every week, just constantly talking to other business owners, looking constantly online at Colliers or whatever those websites were. And one day, I think in maybe October of that year, Chuck, who is the owner of Fet, called me and said, hey, do you want to be in Chinatown? But I'm going to go back home. I'm going to Athens, and I'll let you know when I come back. And that guy didn't call me for a couple weeks and kind of left me hanging. So I called him back, and I'm like, are you going to tell me about that space? And he's like, oh, yeah, it's next door to me. And that's how we found out that Encore was looking to sell their space. And fast forward, we signed a lease on April 1st, 2024, and we were open by June 4th. It was a really, really fast process.
Do you ever catch any flack from like old Encore customers who come in and are like, man, where's Encore? We miss Encore. Or are they just stoked that you're there?
I think in the beginning, like, people definitely miss Encore. I think rightfully so. Like, they were such a big part of getting the neighborhood to where it is now. But with the blessing of Danny and Johnny selling us the space and trusting it to us, we really want to carry that legacy forward. We want to be part of the community. We want to serve whoever comes in through the door, no matter where they're from or like why they're there, you know. That's really important for us because, again, we live in the neighborhood, and this neighborhood is so special and so important for us that we definitely want to carry on the spirit of having a very locally based restaurant, not just in terms of the product that we serve, but also in the sense of like the community that we serve. Because Chinatown has always been, throughout the years, like a kind of a rough place, but every year we live here, it gets better and better. And like, we're so proud to be a part of that journey.
Yeah, this year was an exciting year. So you won Best New Restaurant Holly Aina Awards, and then turned around, what was it, 1 month later, and got this Bon Appetit recognition. How has it been in the restaurant since you got that recognition?
It's been insanely busy, which is awesome for us and the team as a whole. You know, when we started this project, like getting these awards and accolades was never part of the vision. Our plan since the beginning was, okay, we need to serve what we're most proud of and the things that we love the most in this world and offer the same kind of hospitality that we would expect from like the best places that we've dined in or worked in. And that was always the main goal. I tell my cooks all the time, we don't chase awards. We don't chase recognition. All we chase is getting a little bit better every day. And I think like through that process of slowly chipping away at maybe bad old habits and developing better new ones and growing together as a team, we've built something that has gotten these awards, which is amazing for us and the team together to achieve.
What is your strategy moving forward? Because now that you've got double the business, and more people are going to want to come and check you guys out, what's the plan moving forward?
I think the plan for us moving forward is, and always has been, was to create a restaurant that has sustainability, not only because we signed a very long lease, not only because we want to be part of this neighborhood, but really for us, our main goal is to have a team that challenges us, have a team that gets better, have a team that we see grow beyond us, whether that is they want to open a restaurant, whether it is they want to have a place of stability so that they can fulfill their other dreams, whether that be in media or opening their own bar or having a family. That's what Bao and I envisioned always. It's something that through working through many places, we've seen get very far away from that and get very close to that. And so, you know, our dream and our goal for the future is to be around for a long time. And I think that both of us kind of touched upon this, but treating your guests is great, and we always want to treat our guests well, but treat your team even better than that.
How did you decide to make it Italian-Asian fusion?
So that's a good question, because in the beginning, for the pop-up of Giovedi, we're envisioning like a very fine dining, very traditional Italian concept, because those are the kinds of restaurants I worked in New York City for the majority of my career. But the more and more we went through notes and brainstormed and went through what we could serve, the more disconnected I felt from the whole process. And I think it's from the entirety of my career as a chef, like I think many young cooks and chefs can relate to this, but like, you're kind of put into a box, right? You can serve this, you can't serve that because it doesn't fall into the quote-unquote traditional cuisine that you're trying to accomplish. So I figured, you know, I love Italian cuisine because the Italian chefs that taught me how to make this food taught me so many great techniques. And like, it's a cuisine I fell in love with. Even after working in Italy for 3 months in my early 20s, like I fell in love with the country, the people, the food. But also I needed to recognize like my upbringing and how I was brought up and raised as an Asian American in America. And there are so many unique flavors and textures and memories in those foods that I needed to also showcase. So like, how do you bring those two together? I think the goal of the cuisine at Giovedi is always, it's Italian, but also Asian, but we can never offend either of the two. So the hardest part for us is like, okay, what fits together? What would make sense traditionally if like an Asian person was thrown in Italy or an Italian person was thrown into Japan? What food would they cook with the ingredients available to them? Hawaii is a very unique place for that because it's a huge melting pot. So many Asian cultures, even in Chinatown, you walk down Hotel Street or King Street on a random Monday or Tuesday, you might hear 3 or 4 different dialects of Chinese, Filipinos, Japanese, Vietnamese, everywhere. So like, how can we bring those flavors together in a way that both celebrates tradition, but also pushes the culinary envelope forward, where we can serve the two cuisines that I'm most proud of growing up, which would be East Asian and Italian. So that's our goal.
Well, I think you guys were very successful at accomplishing that. And I know I'm a little biased because I work part-time at Giovedi, full disclosure. But it's very exciting, and I just wanted to say congratulations to you two, and hopefully there's many, many, many more years to come of Giovedi.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Can you work tomorrow?
That was contributor Sarah Burchard, helping us to get to know Jen Akiyoshi and Chef Bao Tran. They are the owners of Giovedi in Chinatown, which Bon Appetit just named one of the 20 best restaurants in the country for 2025. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, a decision by the Federal Department of Education to no longer consider nursing as a professional degree is reverberating across Hawaii's nursing schools. This is the country faces a nursing shortage. Are you a nurse or studying to be one? Share your story. Call our talk back line, 808-792-8217. Find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.